The following Dharma talk was recorded in February 2014 in Kansas City, Kansas. It is one of eight recordings from the retreat called Awakening with Insight, Cultivating Concentration and Mindfulness, taught by Shyla Catherine and Phil Jones. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Shyla Catherine is the founder of Insight Meditation South Bay in Mountain View, California. She has practiced meditation since 1980 with more than 8 years of accumulated silent retreat experience. Shyla has authored two books, Focused and Fearless, A Meditator's Guide to States of Deep Joy, Calm, and Clarity, and Wisdom Wide and Deep, A Practical Handbook for Mastering Jhana and Vipassana. Find out more about Shyla at www.imsb.org. Phil Jones has been teaching insight meditation since 1996. He has studied with teachers from Spirit Rock and the Insight Meditation Society, and graduated from the first Community Dharma Leader Program in 2000. Phil has served on Mid-America Dharma's Board of Directors since the mid-1990s. Find out more about Phil at www.silentmindopenheart.org.
The theme for tonight's talk is equanimity. This is a factor that we find included in many Buddhist lists. It's one of the four Brahmaviharas. It's one of the seven factors of enlightenment. And it's a feeling of happiness that is associated with the deep absorption states of jhana. Equanimity, upekkha, is considered an ethical quality, something that we are encouraged to cultivate and develop. It's a lot more than just the mere experience of a neutral feeling. The near enemy of upekkha, what it might appear as but is not, what it's easily mistaken for, is indifference, a quality that includes a kind of withdrawal or avoidance of experience. This withdrawal or avoidance should not be confused with equanimity, because equanimity is animated with interest. It allows a deep presence, interest in whatever is occurring, because that's what's occurring. We may not always recognize equanimity because it's quite subtle. Sometimes we recognize equanimity because we notice the absence of the desire to move toward what we like and away from what we don't like. We recognize that the habitual tendencies towards desire and aversion have ceased. And in that experience, equanimity is established. When I was doing some intensive equanimity practice as part of a four-month Brahmavihara retreat, I remember describing equanimity as cool. So cool. Not a dramatic feeling, not as delightful and joyful as appreciative joy, not as heartfelt as compassion, and not as happy as loving kindness, but deliciously cooled out and not agitated. We can develop equanimity in many ways. It is an exquisitely refined quality that's available to us in this conditioned realm of mind and body. It may be the highest state of happiness available in this mind and body. We find equanimity developing in many parts of our lives. Ram Dass often said that life is your curriculum. We learn from life situations, not trying to avoid and control and contain them, but instead we meet the experiences of the moment and learn. Are we able to stay steady and connected with the vicissitudes of life? Equanimity enables us to stay present as our life unfolds, equally close to the things that we like and the things that we don't like, equally close to all things. Many years ago, my mentor, Christopher Titmus, suggested that there were two arenas to cultivate equanimity within. One was the spectrum of pleasure and pain, and the other was in all things regarding the future results. And this has become a kind of guide for me in the development of equanimity. Throughout every day, there are innumerable changes of experience, changes of feeling. Sometimes a moment is pleasant, and then a moment later, something is unpleasant. Sometimes our perceptions flutter between these two feelings, and sometimes our experiences are not distinctively characterized by either pleasure or pain. And yet it's all life, and for the most part, life is beyond what we can control and what we can predict. But one thing we do know about life is it includes both the painful and the pleasant. And the question isn't, is pain or pleasure going to arise? We know that pain and pleasure is going to arise in our lives. The question is, are we going to be tossed and turned by that? Or can we stay steady in the face of the inevitable shifts from pleasure to pain and pain to pleasure? Can we stay balanced, equanimous, peaceful, accepting? These qualities of balance of mind reveal a depth of understanding that things are the way that they are. The traditional teaching describes 8 worldly conditions, or the 8 worldly winds: gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, and pleasure and pain. There are so many examples in life of something occurring and disappearing, of gain and loss. Civilizations arise and pass away. Leaders become famous and then are completely forgotten. Romances begin and then they end. One act, one gesture, one event can be both praised and blamed, depending on who one speaks with. I find this all the time with teaching Dhamma. I'll give a Dhamma talk, and there'll be a group of people in the room. One person will say it is the best Dhamma talk they have ever heard. And another person will say, it was really boring. It wasn't up to snuff. Almost anything that we do will not be universally blamed, nor will it be universally praised. A cook makes a dish. One person will say it has too much salt. The other person will say it has not enough salt. One person will say it has too much spice and pepper. Another one will say it's a little bland. It's almost inevitable that we will receive both praise and blame. So it's worth developing some equanimity to not fear the blame, nor become overly thrilled when we are praised. When I was staying in the monasteries in Thailand, we used to try to develop equanimity with our foods. We had one meal a day, and we ate in a kind of bowl, something like this. I had a small coconut bowl, a lot smaller than this, but it was still a coconut bowl. And we would go through our line. There would be like a buffet, And you take a little bit of each dish. And one of the practices they suggested was, instead of going through and picking the curries and the fruits and the things that you like, just go through and take one spoon of each dish, regardless of whether you like it. And take the same portion of the thing you know you're going to like and the thing you don't know you're not going to like. Just be even about it. That's one way of approaching it. Another way is to notice how you usually arrange your food, because even though it was all in one little coconut bowl, at first I got very skillful about arranging the banana to make a kind of division, and then putting some of the rice to kind of keep the curry on the rice half and not have it mix in with the salads or with the desserts. So I kind of make myself this little arrangement. They said, no, don't do that. They said, just put everything all in one bowl and then stir it all up. And then eat it. So you mix your dessert in with your curries. You mix, if you happen to get a cupcake in with your pad thai and your whatever this and whatever stir-fried vegetable that and this, you mix it all together and eat it. Okay, so that was one level, and that was challenging. But once that became easy, then they said, okay, so now take a glass, mix it all together, and then take a glass of water, pour it in, and then stir it together and eat it. And see if you can maintain some balance of mind then. So often we're reaching for the pleasant. And yet, it's just food that we consume for nutritional value. In the middle-length discourses, the Buddha said, when a bhikkhu sees a form with the eye, there arises in him what is agreeable, there arises what is disagreeable, and there arises what is both agreeable and disagreeable. He understands, thus, there has arisen in me what is agreeable. There has arisen what is disagreeable. There has arisen what is both agreeable and disagreeable. But that is conditioned, gross, dependently arisen. This is peaceful. This is sublime. That is equanimity. The agreeable that arose, the disagreeable that arose, and the both agreeable and disagreeable that arose, cease in him and equanimity is established. So the Buddha is acknowledging that feelings are going to arise on contact with experience. Some things will be pleasant and agreeable to us. Some will be painful and disagreeable to us. Feeling comes with the experience, and there's not much that we can do to affect the nature of our experience, but there is a lot that we can do to affect how we relate to the experience. And so this discourse goes on to employ a number of different similes that describe a smoothness and an ease of establishing equanimity regarding each of the sense doors, forms cognizable by the eye. He says, regarding forms cognizable by the eye, a man with good sight, having opened his eyes, might shut them, or having shut his eyes, might open them. So, too, concerning anything at all, the agreeable that arose, the disagreeable that arose, and the both agreeable and disagreeable that arose, cease just as quickly, just as rapidly, just as easily, and equanimity is established. So equanimity becomes established as simply as opening and closing our eyes, not a strenuous activity. Regarding sounds cognizable by the ear, he uses the example, he says, just as raindrops on a slightly sloping lotus leaf roll off and do not remain there, so too, concerning anything at all, the agreeable that arose, the disagreeable that arose, and the both agreeable and disagreeable that arose, cease just as quickly, just as rapidly, just as easily, and equanimity is established. Can we let feelings roll off of us as easily as quickly as water rolling off a slightly sloping lotus leaf. It doesn't need to cause a reaction to penetrate us and remain. It's just feeling that's known, arising and passing. Regarding flavors cognizable by the tongue, he likens it to a strong man who could easily spit out a ball of spittle that was already collected on the tip of his tongue. It was that easy. And regarding mind objects cognizable by the mind, he said it was like a hot iron skillet that had been heated for a whole day, and two or three drops of water fall onto that hot iron skillet or plate. And he says that the falling of the drops might be slow, but they would quickly vaporize and vanish. So too, concerning anything at all, the agreeable that arose, the disagreeable that arose, and the both agreeable and disagreeable that arose cease just as quickly, just as rapidly, just as easily, and equanimity is established. Can we let life's pleasant and unpleasant experiences arise, be known, and pass away just that easily? These illustrations point to the fact that feeling arises, and our practice is not going to stop feeling from arising. There is pleasant, there is unpleasant, and there is neither pleasant nor unpleasant feelings. This is a natural part of experience. But when feelings arise, what do we do? Can we see that they have arisen, know the feeling, and then investigate it to see the characteristics of what has arisen, to recognize that it is conditioned, that it is impermanent, that it arises and passes away. So we see it clearly. We bring mindfulness and investigation to the experience of feeling so that it does not penetrate the mind and remain. The consequence of this balanced attention is that equanimity is established quickly and easily. There's no struggle in these similes. And the power is not by forcing the mind to stay balanced, to not react, but instead it's because we see with wisdom the impermanent nature of things. We stop imposing our expectations, our grasping, our clinging, and our personal desires. Equanimity is not an incredibly dramatic feeling, but it is one of the highest forms of material happiness that we can know in the human life. The mistake that most people know The mistake that most people make is to forget to see the characteristics of experience, to forget to see the context of things. What do they depend on? In essence, we forget to investigate the impermanent and conditioned nature of our feeling, and so we are caught by reactions. If we saw the impermanence, we would see the ungraspability, the unsatisfactoriness, and the emptiness, almost inevitably. But sometimes we just forget to see that far. We forget to look that carefully. If you find yourself repeating the same patterns, caught by the same tendencies, then rather than just think this is who I am, this is just the kind of person that I am, I think it would be useful to take some time to investigate those patterns, to see what they're based on, to see how they function, to cultivate a little reflective investigation in the midst of our practice. If you're not sure how to investigate, then it's enough to simply recognize that things change. Impermanence is the primary characteristic that we observe in Vipassana practice. We see how things arise, how they change, and how they cease. Or we just can look more closely to see our own experience more carefully. Notice the beginning and the middle and the ending of each breath. Not just the general fact that we're breathing, but notice the beginning and the middle and the ending of each experience, each emotion, each sensation, each response. We see the same characteristics of change every day in the weather. Overcast when we wake up, sunny in the afternoon, cool in the evening. We all know that the weather changes, and we don't expect anything otherwise. Can we bring that same balanced expectation to our own lives, to the experience of this body? Why is it so surprising, so shocking, when there's pain? Equanimity arises through seeing what is with wisdom, so that we relate to things with ease, present for any feeling that might arise. Equanimity could be said to be an expression of wisdom, the wisdom that sees the impermanent nature of all things and puts an end to conflict. Regarding future results, we have to learn to stay steady with our experience as it's unfolding in the present moment, as this present moment becomes the next present moment and is followed by the next present moment. To know what is under our control and what is not under our control. You may actually find that surprisingly little is under your control. We can make intentions. We can put forth right effort. There's a tremendous amount that we can cultivate and that we can do. We can make wise choices. But perhaps we may not actually be in total control over how things unfold. If so, if we were in control, if we were in control of this body, we might choose not to be sick, not to be uncomfortable, maybe even not to age or die. If we were in control of this mind, we'd probably choose not to forget anything. We'd probably choose not to suffer, not to have angry states or addictive desires. But nevertheless, we have the body, we have the mind, and neither one is under our control. The best we can do is to work wisely with it, moment by moment. There are so many times in my own life when opportunities and situations appeared and disappeared and took me to places I would not have planned, could not have predicted. In fact, there are many times I think when I look back at my life and I wonder, how the heck did I get here? I never would have thought this, that I'd be doing this or that I would be there or that I would have done that or that I would be thinking this, 10 years ago. I think we all probably can look at our lives and wonder, how did I get here? What brought me here? So much is unpredictable. I think traveling as a practice is a wonderful way of loosening the grip on the belief that our lives are under our control. I spent quite a few years traveling in Asia, primarily in India, also Thailand and Nepal and China. And I was often surprised to find myself someplace that I had never even heard of a week before. It was not on my itinerary. It was in a completely different province than I had expected to be in. And I just was there, you know, following opportunities, responding to health conditions, meeting different friends, finding a place that for one reason or another led from one interest to the next, to the next, to the next, and hearing of something, some teaching going on someplace or some teacher some other place. And responding to it. It was quite interesting. Traveling is a situation when we might have the freedom to follow those impulses, but wherever we go, we have relatively little control over what we find there. When I was in India, they had certain holidays where it was best to just stay in your room and hide. So I didn't know about all these holidays on my first trip, and I sometimes found myself in places I probably shouldn't have been. And the only thing to do was to just go back into the hotel and to wait for it to pass. I sometimes would expect certain things to happen, like I wanted to change money, so I went to a bank, brought my traveler's checks, but they didn't have cash. So my plan didn't unfold as I had expected. I went to the post office and expected to find stamps, but no, they didn't have this. I was in China and went to a money changer booth, the only one in the airport, and they didn't have money to change. So how do you get out of the airport? Traveling forces us to be flexible. It forces us to let go of the idea that we think we know how things should be. At home, in our own routines, in our own little cultures, or in our subcultures within a culture, we may expect things to go the way that we plan them, the way that we think they should. And fairly often they do. This can delude us into thinking that we actually have control. One of my friends, when I was traveling in India, used a phrase. One time he said this. I had gone into a chemistry shop, a pharmacy, to buy some aspirin. They didn't have aspirin. and I was like, I didn't get it. And he saw me, like, looking completely perplexed, because I really thought the clerk understood what I was asking for. and he just whispered over to me, he said, "This is India." And that became a kind of mantra that he would remind me of, is, "Ah, this is India." And I had come here to experience it. I didn't stay home so that I could stay within my routine and have everything the way that I wanted it. I didn't stay within my particular pattern. So could I actually open up to this experience, to being where I was, in India with all its beauty and also its confusing frustrations? Could I open to the experience and rest in the presence of things as they are, even if they weren't the way that I would have wanted them to be? I lived for a while in a spiritual community. And this community would have community meetings. And some of the things on the agenda was somebody left the toilet seat up. Somebody used margarine instead of butter. Somebody hung their laundry in the wrong place. Somebody did their weekly chores on Tuesday when the chore day is on Wednesday. you get the idea, right? There was, over the course of the year that I was in this community, there was an unbelievable number of things that were done wrong. And every time somebody wanted to make a rule, except they called them an agreement, until finally, it just was, meetings became a complete joke. Unfortunately, a rather sad joke. Wouldn't it be better to use the situations to learn to free the mind rather than to just make policy so that we don't have to be inconvenienced or have anything outside of our comfortable mold? The Buddha taught us what kinds of actions lead to happiness and what kinds of actions lead to suffering. It doesn't actually matter in the scope of what leads to happiness and what leads to suffering whether chores are done on Tuesday or whether they're done on Wednesday and whether laundry is hung over here or over there. It actually doesn't matter to the end of suffering whether margarine is used or butter is used. The Buddha instead taught kamma, the intentionality of action, and how our actions ripen in fruits, but that ripening process is unfathomable. We cannot actually know what will come as a result of our actions. Sure, we can act with good intentions. Sure, we can be mindful and careful in the development of our actions, but we cannot predict the exact result. In meditation, it's important to not judge ourselves by what is occurring in the practice, especially not to judge our practice because it was pleasant, therefore good, or painful, therefore bad. To not judge a calm meditation as good and an agitated meditation as bad, or a clear meditation as good and a dull meditation as bad. These are not the criteria upon which to evaluate our practice. Anything related to feeling, pleasant and pain, is not a good basis upon which to assess the development of our practice. It's better to simply ask, can I be with this? Can I be present with this? Can I be with whatever is actually happening without the mind going into states of agitation? Can I be with can I be present with dullness as well as clarity? Can I be interested in irritation as well as calmness? On one three-month retreat back in the 1980s, I was interviewing with Sharon Salzberg. And she often said the same thing to me. She'd say, that's okay, and sent me back to the meditation hall to continue to meditate. And, you know, I was a happy, eager little yogi, so that was fine for the first few months, maybe 6 weeks or so. I don't know, it was somewhere around in the second month after I just cared, that's okay, and I go back and keep meditating. That's okay, because I had for weeks been describing very painful experiences, and she kept saying, that's okay, go back and meditate. And so finally I turned to her and I said, no, it's not okay. And she looked back at me and she said, no, it is okay. It's fine. The experience is fine. But it doesn't matter what's happening. Our job is to be present for it. It doesn't matter if what's happening is what we like or what we don't like, what is pleasant or what is unpleasant. Can we be present for it? That's enough. That's okay. If we are wanting some particular experience to happen, usually happiness, usually lightness, concentration, okay, we can throw in some deep absorption states and maybe an awakening experience now and then. We won't turn down, right? Okay, That's fine. We can, it's fine enough to want that. But if we're really obsessed with worrying about what is going to happen or expecting something to happen, how present can we really be for what is happening? All we can really do is train ourselves. We can train our minds. We can train ourselves towards virtue and understanding. But how things unfold, we cannot control. We can bring our attention to the meditation object, but we cannot force the mind into a state of samadhi. We can look carefully at our experience, but we cannot demand that insight arise. As Sharon also said, we can do the practice, but we cannot make it work. We can incline our minds again and again to states that are wholesome, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom, qualities that generally lead to happiness and away from suffering. But exactly what will happen in the next sitting or in the next day or in the next year is well beyond our control, because the future is a surprise. Would we really want it to be any other way? Seriously, would you want your life to have been limited to what you could have predicted and planned? I certainly wouldn't. Let's let the future be a surprise. But if the truth is that we don't know what will happen, then how do we develop equanimity? There are several modes or approaches to the development of equanimity. It's actually a natural consequence, or it naturally arises in association with mindfulness. So the practice of mindfulness calms the reactions, and the mind that meets experience as it is equanimous. Concentration practices develop tranquility and that non-reactive stability of mind, which is a profound support for equanimity. Just the commitment to return again and again and again to your meditation object will teach the mind to be unattracted and unrepulsed by potentially distracting events. And so then the mind becomes less sticky when it's concentrated, less reactive, more equanimous, more balanced, more steady, more even in a concentrated state. Reflection practices also develop equanimity. Perhaps the Brahmaviharas are one of the clearest reflection practices. And this will include a reflection on conditionality and karma, because we're understanding when we reflect on conditionality that things are not under our control, that they arise due to causes and conditions. People are not happy because we wished, may you be happy and free from suffering. People will not be free from pain because we wish, may you be free from pain and not suffer. We need, along with the Brahmavihara practices of loving kindness, compassion, and appreciative joy, we need the practice of equanimity to balance the mind so that we know that things unfold due to causes and conditions, not because of our wishes. And yet, we wish well. But ultimately, it's life that develops equanimity as we open more fully day in and day out to whatever arises in the context of our lives. There are many practical things we can do to cultivate equanimity. Right in this retreat, we can cultivate equanimity just by sitting a little bit longer, you might think. A little bit longer. These are already really long sittings. But a few extra minutes here and there can be very interesting. After you hear the bell ring, don't just get right up because the bell rang. I mean, really, do you want to live your life according to a bell. Sit through the wave of the bell. Let other people get up and walk out, and just stay steady until your own intention arises to conclude the sitting and to get up and walk. You don't have to do that every time, but once in a while, just to establish a bit of ease and equanimity in the mind. You can also make the commitment to not shift postures, to not scratch or fidget, to stay very still, even take a vow of stillness. I don't suggest you do that for hours at a time. Start with 5 minutes. Just 5 minutes. And during those 5 minutes, don't blink, don't move, don't shift. If you're uncomfortable, just feel it. Just rest in it. Just open to it. Just allow it. This can be a very interesting practice, but if you need to move for the health of your body, if you have an injury, then please feel free to move, move from sitting to standing, alternate your postures in different sittings from the floor to the chairs, try different chairs if these aren't suitable for you, try a different one, there's a variety of chairs in this building. Find a way to be comfortable, and then within that comfort, extend yourself a bit. We all experience pain in life, some mild, some severe, and it's worth taking the opportunity in the context of meditation to pick up some of the mild pains, the pains that we're sure are not life-threatening. Nobody yet has died of an itch. It may feel like it, but it's not going to kill you. Nobody yet has actually bruised their sit bones from sitting for an hour. No, you might feel the pressure, you might feel the hardness, you might feel the sharpness, but it's really not going to hurt you. And these kinds of experiences are good ones to practice with. Some people feel a little tension sometimes. Maybe there's over-efforting or strain, and there can be a little bit of tension around the jaw or around the eyes or on the face. Not life-threatening. You're not likely to need a surgery by the end of the retreat for your. So these are kinds of things that you can just use as meditation objects sometimes. We can develop equanimity around situations that are inconvenient. You know, like when we have to wait, or when we don't exactly get what we want at the food line, or we wanted whole milk and there was only 2%, or we wanted half and half and there's only coffee creamer. It's a bit of an inconvenience, but we can practice with that. Rather than shift the blame onto society or an institution or a system or a person, or make a rule so we don't have to experience it again, we can take the opportunity to rest in the experience of being inconvenienced. Just that, inconvenienced. It's not the way we want, but our mind remains balanced, even as we recognize that we're not getting what we want. We can learn to wait gracefully. Sometimes we have to wait when weather changes a flight pattern and we miss a connection, or we have to wait when you're in the grocery store and the person ahead of you makes a mistake and has to redo the whole order, but you've already unloaded your groceries onto that thing, so there's no point in going to another stall. You just have to stand there and wait. These are all great practice opportunities. But of course, aging, loss, illness, and accidents are always good opportunities to develop equanimity. But it's important that equanimity not only be developed in the painful situations. We also need to remain steady and not swept off our feet when things are really going our way, when we're praised, when we're flattered, when we're successful. when we have good fortune. Because if we're unduly influenced by praise and approval, then we might become gullible at the mercy of con artists or advertisers or salesmen. We might accept low standards to be not threatening. We might make decisions in order to get somebody's approval rather than look at long-term gain, not long-term goals. In the Brahmavihara practice, equanimity is developed very specifically. And it's developed by using a phrase, all beings are the heirs to their own karma. Their happiness or unhappiness depends upon their actions, not my wishes for them. Sometimes it's shortened to things as they are. But the real essence of the development of equanimity as a Brahmavihara is to consider the link to karma and conditionality. This reflection reminds us that although we earnestly wish for beings to be happy, we can't control their happiness. Things arise and pass away, not according to our schedule, but simply due to the presence or absence of causes. In the Samyutta Nikaya, there's an interesting discourse that talks about 8 conditions that lead to the arising of feeling. And I think it's important when we reflect upon karma to consider this discourse, because too often people pick up on the idea that our actions influence our results, that what we did in the past is a determining factor for how we feel in the present, and how we respond to the present is the determining factor to how we will feel in the future. So basically, if we're in pain now, it's because we did something bad in the past. And if we're experiencing good fortune and pleasure now, it's because we did something good. And the extremes of this are the rather callous statements that sometimes you hear somebody make, something like, all those people who suffered in the hurricane or in the tsunami or in some war or a terrorist attack must have had some collective karma together in a previous past life. Not only does nobody know, that's not what I'm saying in the terms of this discourse, is not just that nobody knows that, it's that that's not what the Buddha taught. That's not what he's taught as karma. He taught that there were 8 conditions that affect the occurrence of what happens and what the feeling arises, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. 4 of them have to do with health and the conditions of the body. They're described as being bile, phlegm, imbalances of bile, imbalances of phlegm, imbalances of winds, and a combination of the imbalance of the 3. So basically, 4 things have to do with the body. Then there's a climate, accidents, assault, and the 8th is karma. Out of these 8 conditions, we can see that there are combinations of things that determine the feelings that we have now. Our previous actions are only one of them. So when we reflect on this phrase, all beings are the owners of their own karma, their own past action. Their happiness or unhappiness depends upon their actions, not my wishes for them. We shouldn't use it as an excuse to blame someone for their own actions or for their own suffering. But it's simply a reflection that brings a realistic perspective to what it is we can and what it is we cannot control. Equanimity matures when we're able to contact both the pleasant and the unpleasant experiences without being thrown off balance. The 3rd Zen patriarch is famous for saying, The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. Equanimity is a very smooth, it's a very cool, it's a very lovely way of relating to experience. So lovely, in fact, that it can sometimes be confused with enlightenment, with freedom, and with awakening. In one of my equanimity retreats, I approached my teacher in an interview. It was Christopher Titmus, and I was speaking of describing the mind that was free from desire and aversion and was really enjoying and this bliss of ease, of coolness. And fair enough, during that period, there had been a long time when desire and aversion simply were not arising, because of the strength of the equanimity. But in his wisdom, he rather matter-of-factly reminded me that equanimity is a conditioned state. It is an extraordinary state, necessary in life, vital in practice, but it is a relative quality of mind. It is not the aim of this path. I and mine still operate, even within deep states of equanimity, as the subtle position of the meditator, the very sense of being the one who was not reacting with desire for the pleasant or aversion towards the unpleasant, revealed the limitations of equanimity. This extraordinary bliss, this peaceful bliss of equanimity, has to be seen with insight as conditioned, impermanent phenomena. We shouldn't underestimate the importance and the strength of this steadiness, but we must know that it is merely a conditioned state. When equanimity is strong, the mind will not be compelled to move towards desire for the pleasant and aversion towards from the unpleasant. But there might still be the position of the experiencer, the I position, and therefore it is not freedom, it is not awakening. As one friend is fond of saying, as long as there is an I, there is still work to be done.